Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Machine. I'm your co-host, Corey, and I'm here with co-host and friend, Nathan. Nathan, how are you tonight?
I'm doing fine, Corey. How are you?
I'm great. Excellent. Thank you. I didn't ask you how you were in return last time, and I got the gears from my friend, so I'm reciprocating.
Is that right? Hey, wow. Yeah. You better really watch yourself now. Everything you say is going to be used against you.
That's true. So I'm looking forward to this episode two, where we dig into you, Nathan, a little bit here. I'm excited about for a number of reasons. I know that your story is an interesting one. And I also know that you're a person who creates a lot of space for the stories of others and for the community that you're a part of. And that space has been beneficial to a lot of people. And so it's a cool opportunity to be able to allow you to share a bit and to find out more about you.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. So Nathan, if you want to start off just with sharing with the listener about sort of who you are, start with professionally, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I'm a community pharmacist by profession. That's the type of pharmacist that you most commonly see. I did do some hospital rotations when I was in school. Graduated from UBC in 2009, and I've worked in many, many pharmacies since that time, all over BC and the Lower Mainland. And so that's the what my professional title would be a community pharmacist. Most of the time now I manage pharmacies or do consulting work for pharmacies that are opening. Independence and such. And the other thing I do is I run an online company called Obsidian Support Services BC. And that's a organization I started after I got back from rehab in hopes that I would be able to help people who were stuck with some of the peer group models that I saw when I was over east in Guelph that I thought were something that could be improved upon. So, so what we do there is I provide a space for people to come together via Zoom. So most of us are from BC. We do have some people who are outside of BC, but most of my members are from BC. And we come together a couple times a week. And basically it's for everybody who's got stuck in the machine with what they call monitoring contracts. So basically once you get in trouble with substance abuse, one of the things that happens when you get back to work is you're put into a return to practice agreement or a monitoring contract, and basically you're followed for usually 3 to 5 years. During that time, they want you to attend peer support meetings. So I thought it would be good if I could provide the model of meeting that I thought would be helpful. In other words, one that places honesty ahead of everything else, as opposed to some of the other ones that are more, it's almost like the facilitator's job is to police the members. So I didn't like that. I want it to be, because if people feel like they can't trust the other people in the meeting, then basically nothing really gets exchanged. It becomes just a, another hoop to jump through.
Yeah. And that sort of that vulnerability and the integrity as a starting point reflects in how comfortable the group seems to be, at least in the meetings that I attend with you, Nathan, for sure. I am fortunate enough that I don't have anything to compare it to where there's sort of a punitive atmosphere or a atmosphere of fear.
You are fortunate. I've seen some wild stuff.
So can you share with us, taking us back in the story to your experience with addiction? What was your workplace setting like at that point when things started? Were you working in a community pharmacy at that point?
Yeah, I know, because we discussed these questions and thought they'd be good starting points. I spent quite a bit of time thinking about it, and it's kind of funny because I know when I asked you, you couldn't there wasn't a specific time that you could place or a specific incident. And for me, it's the same way. I mean, I don't think my workplace setting was necessarily the primary driver in my particular problem. It certainly didn't help. And I think probably the most dangerous thing about my job is the access, because you're dealing with, especially when things were worse, the worst times for me were when I was managing a store that was just doing a tremendous volume of all the most addictive substances. We were servicing a cancer facility as well. And there was a lot of meds coming back, or, you know, where you get somebody who picks up 3 months worth of medication and then passes away, and the family brings back their meds. So you're basically, the workspace itself is awash. I mean, there's just, you can't destroy or remove the narcotics fast enough at the rate that they're coming back in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that part of it, basically, when it's that easy, it doesn't take much. Once you've kind of tipped in that direction, then it's very easy to keep going. So in that respect, pharmacy is one of the more dangerous professions for that. I think the most dangerous would probably be your anesthesiologists, and anybody who's got, you know, complete and total access to, you know, basically the most pure, reliable source of drugs in the world.
So can you describe to the audience what was your drug of choice at that time, and how did your sort of role in the pharmacy, you outlined it there a bit about sort of how things were coming in. Again, that was in the community setting, Nathan?
That was in a community setting. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what was your drug of choice at that time?
Oxycodone and OxyContin. And just to give you a little backstory as to kind of my experience with opiates overall, I mean, I made it till I was, I don't know, age 20-ish, I think, without really considering opiates at all. I mean, I might have had some T3s at some point, but I don't recall ever having any kind of a pleasurable response from them or anything like that. I just, basically everything was fine until I had a situation happen where I was a Canadian, probably pretty Canadian anecdote here, but I was out chasing a moose, and we went down into this swamp area, and being a teenager, I guess I figured I was invincible, but I was taking chances on terrain that I shouldn't have been, and I ended up injuring myself pretty badly. So what happened with that is I had to have surgery, and that was my first introduction to any kind of substance like that. And I can remember it was meperidine, or Demerol is the trade name for that one. And they were giving it to me IM, and it was intramuscular shot. The first one I got, I immediately responded extremely positively. Pain went away, but it was more than that. It was like a sheer, just a wall of euphoria. So, I mean, it was a dose or two, and then I was trying to talk the nurse into more, you know, just instant pull, right?
Yeah.
I can remember just at nighttime laying in my bed, and it was raining outside, and I was watching the raindrops as they accumulated and then dripped down the window outside, and I had this game going where I'd named all the raindrops, and there was a race going on there, and I just remember that I was having the time of my life. It was like the best day ever. And so I think that was the initial hook. I'd never felt that before. And then that kind of set the stage for a slow descent after that, that took many, many years, where just through recreational drug use and taking bigger and bigger risks. Eventually, I got to the point where I was working in a pharmacy. I think it started with, I was still back that time, getting migraines occasionally. And I believe I needed to get through a shift. I couldn't get any coverage. I'd taken my sumatriptan and it wasn't cutting it. I had 4 hours to go and I just took some Percocet just to get through. And that I believe was the start, because the link that formed from that was different than before, in that it just so happened that at that time in my life, I was going through a whole bunch of difficult emotional things at that time. So it not only took the pain away, it took everything away. So all those problems that I should have been dealing with, it was like taking a vacation from them. And it was very, very effective and just very alluring.
Yeah. We've talked about that in the first episode, that the hook of opiates or whatever the drug of choice may be. But in our circumstance with opiates, that the hook sort of needs a vulnerable recipient. Because people receive opiates for surgeries or pain on a regular basis, and most certainly not everyone develops a profound addiction to them, but some do.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, and that's why for example, when veterans got back from Vietnam, you know, there was a tremendous amount of opiate use during that war. And everybody thought that those veterans were going to be lifelong users of heroin. But when they came out of that environment, it actually turned out that the vast majority of them spontaneously recovered with very little treatment or help. Some of them don't have, they got back, they had their family, the friends, and they weren't getting shot at. And that's all it took for them to be okay. And I think that's, you're absolutely right when you say that there has to be some kind of vulnerability along with a certain genetic predisposition, which I believe we both have.
Yeah. So I've got a couple of sort of follow-up questions for you for that. But in addition to some challenges within your personal life, were there factors within the job itself that you look back on and say, you know, that fueled the fire, or that was at least played a role within the addiction starting up?
Well, certainly. I mean, like we talked about before, I think there's not many healthcare jobs out there that aren't going to, you're going to have some stress. I mean, everybody faces some stress, but honestly, community pharmacy it's a difficult job. Well, I'll leave it at that. It's very challenging, as far as you're kind of getting the worst of both worlds, in that you're dealing with the public when the public is not at their best, as in they've either already waited for a long time at the doctor's office, so their patience is gone, or they're sick or in pain. So, and this isn't everybody, but it's a much larger portion than what you'd see in regular retail. So you're dealing with the regular retail stuff only kind of amplified, because people are not generally in a good state when they come to see you. And then that is all compounded by an absolute landslide of bureaucratic red tape and ridiculous forms and just basically, now if you're working in a community pharmacy, one of your primary goals is to make sure that your paperwork is in order, so that the government or one of the third party insurance companies doesn't come and audit you. And it's almost impossible to run a pharmacy perfectly, as far as, well, I say almost, it is impossible. So if you're managing, which I was for the last, I don't know how many years of my career, that burden to make sure that, if you're an owner and you hire a community pharmacist manager to come in and make sure that your store is running properly, that you're getting enough scripts through, that you're making money, But you also have to consider the fact that at any time an audit could show up. And if it does, I mean, you're looking at, you know, depending on how tight you're running the ship, it could be 25,000, it could be 100,000, it could be 500,000 in clawbacks from any one of those insurance companies. And so you've got that hanging over your head, and it's hard to focus on what you're supposed to be focusing on. You know, like, I mean, you go through school and it's, oh yeah, you're going to get out there and you're going to be able to help doctors and patients. And, you know, honestly, 10% of my day when I'm in a pharmacy might be doing that. The rest is, you know, facilitating adjudication issues, dealing with, you know, things that really shouldn't even be an issue. But it's just, I mean, this is the state of affairs. And I don't think that, this isn't to say that it's something that can't be done. And I chose that path. I mean, you know, nobody told me I had to be a pharmacist. I just thought that it aligned with my values and my interests. So, you know, I underestimated the risks. That's all.
And don't you think that disenfranchisement is sort of a part of that recipe? Like that whether it's on a personal level or if it's the job stressors that at least I it comes to mind to me that I'm not sure if I've met someone, met any professionals who have developed an addictive behavior who aren't either disillusioned or disenfranchised by some aspect of it first.
Yeah. Like it sets the tone for sure. You know, when you're, I guess, I mean, if you're working a job that's giving you very, very little satisfaction, so you're not, you know, it's hard to be engaged with it. It's frustrating. You're not finding a lot of meaning. And most likely if you're managing, you know, at the time I didn't set limits like I do now. So I'd be, you know, you'd be pulling a lot of hours just like you were, working as a nurse. And
yeah,
it's, people need to understand that if you're not monitoring yourself and you're not advocating for your own mental health and setting those lines and saying, you know what, like for me, I mean, I won't consistently work full time. You know, I'll maybe do a month at a time, but that's it. Other than that, 3 days a week in a pharmacy is about what is healthy for me now. And even that, I mean, it's, you know, it still takes it out of me, not just because the job is difficult and I don't enjoy it as much as I had hoped I would. It also takes a lot of energy, you know, when I'm counting out Percocet, there's a part of my brain that says, hey, look, you know, it's right there. Hey, there's a solution. Hey, look. And I'm not, you know, I went through a period of time where I was monitored, but I'm not monitored now. And regardless of what any governing body says, if you're a pharmacy manager working in a pharmacy, you can pretty much, you know, you can make it happen, right? At least for a while. So,
you know, I when you were talking about the sort of the stress there and the compounding aspects of the job, and I don't hear an excuse in that. I just hear that these are things that played a role. To me, you know, it was the kind of the very well-known YouTube video by Johan Hari, where he talks about the broken connections. That the opposite of addiction is connection, and that there are things that get in the way of those connections that make us vulnerable to an addiction forming and are contributing factors. And kind of what I hear from what you're saying is that level of stress, of disenfranchisement or disenchantment did play a role.
Oh, it absolutely did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, maybe it's that had I been in a better position and been a little wiser and was able to set up limits for working. And, you know, I mean, in hindsight, maybe it would have been possible for me to do that job without getting into trouble. But I mean, it's not something you think about very much, honestly. I mean, I don't think we got, when I was in UBC, we did, it's 4-year program there. And there wasn't a lot as far as, you know, this is what you watch out for. You know, if this is the way you're feeling, if you're having a hard time, if your personal life is on the rocks, or you're having issues that need to be addressed, you are in significant danger being in an environment with those drugs. There's no question about it. And yeah. I think just having a little bit more awareness there, I mean, it seems obvious, you know, you think, well, I remember thinking, I'm a pharmacist anyway, I know exactly how these drugs work as far as their mechanism of action and what kind of response is elicited in the brain and nervous system. But it's different. And I think that maybe there should be a little more time spent not only talking about the dangers of working in that environment, but also more importantly, what to do if you get into trouble or think you're getting into trouble. And the current path forward with that is, as you know, in all the healthcare professions, is lacking. So, I mean, I remember it was, I don't know at what point I started thinking that I needed to do something, because I couldn't go, you know, I couldn't go 6 hours without something before I started feeling rough. So I'd have to, you know, just having that kind of an addiction hanging over your head it's significant enough to scare you into starting to think of ways out. And I'd exhausted all the ways that I thought I could do it myself. So when I started reaching out, I reached out to we have an association and we have a college, and I reach out to the association. They just gave me a phone number and said, phone this guy. And I was offered three 1-hour sessions of counseling with, I guess, what was supposed to be an addictions expert. I'm not sure what the guy's training was, and I'm sure he was a nice guy and he had the best of intentions, but 3 hours is not going to do anything to fix the situation that I was in. No. I needed significant help, and I needed somebody to trust. But I couldn't find an avenue for that. So the problem persisted and persisted and persisted.
Yeah. And I mean, we're also talking about what we now know. And I please clarify how rapidly after the introduction of oxycodone and after it was sort of introduced to the market, how quickly did the general public or the pharmacy community know how potently addictive it was? And maybe this is an opportunity too. I was hoping you could just give a little bit of a breakdown to the listener about some of these differences, not to get too into the science of it, but oxycodone and OxyContin are quite different from morphine, from codeine, or from hydromorphone in that case too.
Yeah, they are in that. Well, oxycodone is an interesting molecule just because it is a powerful narcotic that was originally designed for, you know, palliative patients or patients who are suffering from cancer related pain and stuff like that. But it came to light that the company who came up with the original patent, Purdue, I'm not sure if you've heard any of the stories about the Purdue company in the, I think it's a Sackler family, something like that. The owners of Purdue, basically their team of scientists who are, you know, these drug companies have teams who work through hundreds and hundreds of molecules looking for anything that'll work. And they had oxycodone, and they'd brought it to human level trials. And they were getting just preposterous addiction numbers back, as in you take this stuff once or twice, much more addictive than morphine, more addictive than heroin. So that was presented to the board at Purdue, and Purdue decided to just bury that information and move forward. So they knew the whole time that what they were doing was putting something out there that was going to make them a lot of money, because it elicits a response in the mind that is, if you have the right genetic subset, it lights you up like a Christmas tree. It takes very, very little to get going on that stuff. And I think that what we saw in the 90s and early 2000s and all the way up until, it took a long time before North America really, we're still suffering. And yeah, this crisis now, that's where it started. It all started back then with these drug companies pushing these pills and the pill mills in the States, and which led to the underground market with fentanyl, and here we are now. As far as Hydromorph, Hydromorph is also a powerful one, powerful medication that it's got similar effects. And I think everybody's got a little bit of, for some people, they take any kind of opiate and it just, they're like, I don't know how people get addicted to this stuff. It makes me feel gross. It makes me feel itchy, or I can't sleep, or I have weird dreams. So there's a big range of different responses to it, but there's enough people out there that respond with a large scale wave of euphoria, such as myself, that it makes it a very dangerous substance to work with if you happen to be in that class.
So while you were at work, what was that doing for you, and what was it doing against you? How was it helping you get through your day, and how, in hindsight, how did it hinder you?
While I was at work, I was pretty good about, I had a max dose that I wouldn't go past a certain limit in the day while I was working. And that was because what I noticed was that there was kind of a sweet spot with it where, if I took too much, my short-term memory started to suffer. And in a pharmacy, you're attending to a lot of things. It's busy. Your memory's fairly taxed on a regular basis. And if it starts to fail on you, it causes a lot of problems and becomes pretty noticeable fast. So I kept it just below that. And what I got from it as far as advantages, besides the fact that it was the only thing keeping me going at that time, because my personal life was so shitty, was that it gives you a level of patience and empathy that would not have been possible otherwise under those circumstances. And just like you, I got the cards, and I've been fortunate enough to have been a pharmacist for long enough that I've gotten positive feedback and negative, of course, over my career. But like you said, when you're in that situation and you're managing a busy store and people are going out of their way to contact the owner about how this guy, went over the top or did all this extra stuff, or was just super kind under duress, or whatever it might have been. And a lot of that, the patience that I was finding was because I could tolerate the environment, and it would not have been the case without it. So that's kind of what I gained, I guess, was patience and empathy at the cost of my, my cognition, right? So you're definitely shaving a few points IQ off, and your short-term memory is taking a beating, but you can stay in the pocket for longer. You can work longer hours. When normally you wouldn't have that gear, like you got it's Friday and the third person is coming up to you, with an unsolvable problem and it's all your fault. You've got that extra gear that you can grab that you wouldn't have otherwise.
So for you, in my case, I was called and told, you're not coming into work. on Friday. For you, what was it that finally led you to either within yourself say, I'm reaching a crisis here, something needs to change? Or had you received any feedback or any inclination from your peers that there was, that they knew about the brewing problem?
Well, what I was doing was, I tend to, at that point in my life, I was moving around a lot. I normally move around quite a bit anyways, but, I was moving around an exceptional amount during that time. And so I wasn't staying in positions. Like I'd come in to a pharmacy, stay for maybe 6 to 9 months, and then move to the next pharmacy. And that's fine. But what I realized eventually was that for some reason, I couldn't get myself to pick up the phone and call the college and say, and I basically could not turn myself in. I tried, I don't know how many times, 6 or 7, where you pick up the phone, you dial the number, and I just hang up. And I don't, like, to this day, I don't know what goes on in a person's mind there. I mean, I knew I was in trouble, but I just didn't, I guess it was the fear of the fall from grace, right? You know, you're thinking about how you're going to disappoint everybody and, you know, what people are going to think about you and, you know, financial ramifications and all that type of stuff. But eventually what happened was I got to a point where I was frustrated with basically not getting caught. So I took a position that, that would give me no room for error. In a smaller store where if I did have a problem, I knew it would show up quickly. And I figured I had, in my mind, I detoxed myself cold turkey at home, which was a brutal experience. I don't recommend doing that. But I took the time to do that between jobs. And I figured that once I'd kind of gotten through the worst of the acute withdrawal, I gave myself a month and I was like, okay, I think I got this under control. I'm ready to go back to work, which is ridiculous, of course. But I mean, at the time, I didn't know anything about post-acute withdrawal. I didn't know how that part of it worked. Not many people do. You know, everyone hears about the initial acute symptoms, but post-acute is not as well known. And so I took this position thinking that, well, this is a small store, so, you know, I can't go wrong. I'm going to be fine. I'll get in there. I'll be able to do my job. And even if there's a problem, I'll certainly get caught because there's basically no way to hide it. And I didn't last very long. I mean, there were obviously factors looking back that were ridiculous, as going back to work that early being one of them. But I mean, the store that I chose was open long hours with nobody around. So basically a new store, you're standing there for 12 hours at a time. I mean, this is a recipe for disaster, right? Yeah. So, I started chipping away again and I got, it wasn't long before the manager of the store gave me a call. I was like, look, I don't know what's going on here, but we need to talk. And when it got to that point, it happened to be, unfortunately, it happened to be that the manager was a friend and was the last person in the world that I guess because of the way my life was going and because of the way the stage of withdrawal then re-entrance into addiction, I really wasn't considering what would happen next. And I put that person through a tremendous amount of, inconvenience and, I still feel bad about that. But they were very understanding and, basically I lost my job immediately and they did what is the standard protocol, which is to contact the college and report diverted narcotics.
I've wanted to ask you this before, actually. And I think it just as sort of a public service almost, that there's profound risk in for the individuals who take themselves off of their drug of choice for a period of time, particularly with opiates, and have a period of time where they are drug free and detoxed and sober, and then put themselves back in the environment of increased risk of relapse, that there's a high incidence of overdose in those circumstances, where your body is clean, you go back to thinking you know what your body can handle, you know what your old dosing was, and you run into, well, trouble is an understatement. You overdose. I've certainly encountered that in the workplace. So I wanted to ask you, is that something that you were afraid of when you went back at that, after that time of off after detoxing?
I wasn't afraid of that. I was aware of it. I think because for me, I never injected anything, right? So all my dosing was just oral pills, and that doesn't mean that it's not extremely dangerous. It just means that you've got a little bit more of a cushion, and
more time,
yeah. And in the fact that I am a pharmacist and I do understand the pharmacokinetics of the way that the those receptors kind of rebound and then put you in a position where you are susceptible to overdose. I did have an understanding of that, which I think helped keep me safe. I remember, you know, things were really, really bad after that. I'd went from a period of my life where everything was, I felt like I just couldn't lose. Like everything was going right. And then I had a year where it was one thing after the other, and it was, looking back on it, I mean, some of the things I couldn't control, but a lot of the things I could have, if I would have addressed them properly. But it's just, you know, you're younger, you're not addressing things properly like you should be addressing things. You're kicking problems down the road and not staying on top of issues. And it led me to a point where I was standing there and I thought, well, I'm in big trouble now, because I've got, you know, I'm going to run out here. I'm going to, you know, there's only so much that I can do as far as, you know, supplying myself. And the option is suffer or go out and try to find something.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, like, yeah, at the time I was in Vancouver, I don't think that would be a very hard task. I could do that. But I just thought, if I do this, there is no going back. You know, if I get out there and I basically turn the whole world into a pharmacy, and then I've got, you know, sources everywhere to find this stuff in my vulnerable state, I won't have, you know, what will stop me, right? And it was so painful to be sober at that time, just because of, I mean, my nervous system was pretty fried, but I had other stuff going on that was, I was in a lot of pain. So I'm very grateful that for whatever reason I made that call and didn't decide to do that. And I just sat with it and basically suffered until things moved forward with the college.
I think there's such a part of a unique quality with professionals. I'll certainly speak for myself that my training and the knowledge that I had, it almost created a false sense of security. And I really related to what you were saying about, you knew the pharmacokinetics and you knew the safety and the dosing, and sort of how to navigate that. And in a different way, I did too. And that sort of creates a sort of an invincible feeling, or a feeling that that you can kind of navigate your circumstance, navigate your situation. And I wonder if you looked at sort of timelines of addictive behaviors for people who are professionals versus those who weren't, if that can actually, if someone is not caught or doesn't turn themselves in, or if there isn't a crisis, if that can make it last longer, because there's this feeling that you're managing and that you know better and it kind of gives you almost a permission.
All of that for sure. I mean, you definitely, there's a certain level of arrogance. There was on my part for sure. In that I thought, well, I know everything about this stuff. It's not going to get me. How can it get me when I know everything about it? Right. Which is nonsense. But as far as timelines go, like, people might be surprised to understand that there is healthcare professionals out there who have been using these types of drugs or other types of drugs daily for decades, and they're still working and they're quite happy to do it. They've just decided that that's the way they're going to run their life. So it's not that every story ends in a disaster or a dose escalation. Like, that's, I was surprised to find that out after I started. Well, once I started Obsidian, I started talking to a lot of people and meeting with addiction specialists, and I interviewed a few people about their, you know, how they were living and how they were working. And it's, you know, some people, they come to a certain point where they're like, you know what, I'm older now. I don't want to go through the pain of trying to change the course that I'm on. I'm just going to keep going until I retire and then deal with it then. And that goes on as well, which is, it's amazing, really, that, I mean, when you think of a drug problem, you think it's not sustainable in that way, but it depends on the individual and it depends on the circumstances, and, you know, everybody's different.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about, what we're told in our training, and how we are prepared in our training. And I think it's probably, just having met some of the people that I've met, safe to say that across the board within healthcare specifically, that there is a small percentage of the curriculum that is dedicated to sort of, personal care and personal maintenance. There's probably a smaller percentage dedicated to the risk of addiction and burnout, and like just all of those little sort of branches of that same tree. And then kind of, I get the feeling, at least from my experience, is that once you're in, and there's a culture where the onus is handed back to the individual. And the onus is on the individual, to be clear, that our own self-care is up to us. It is our own choice and it is our own responsibility. But within that community, there seems to be a real absence of sort of empathetically looking out for one another or observing when some of those warning signs exist.
Yeah, well, it's right from the get-go, it's not realistic. I mean, all these professions, yours, mine, physicians, dentists, veterinarians, anyone who's got access to dangerous substances like that, I mean, there should be a significant portion of your training that is focused on how to spot trouble with yourself, how to help colleagues who are having issues like this. I mean, it goes hand in hand with our culture in general towards work, which is basically you're a hero if you work yourself to death, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, even now when I say, well, it's that I feel that it's not responsible for me. And it's not the right thing for me to do as far as my mental health is concerned to work X amount of hours per week. I'm not saying that because the work sucks, or you know, I have other things to do, or whatever it may be. I'm saying that because I've experienced what happens when you push it too far, and the destruction of your life that occurs from that, from not addressing that and just smashing through like both of us did, is monumental. It's devastating. And I wouldn't wish it upon my worst enemy.
No, the culture within the North American healthcare systems is such that it's working harder, going faster, taking on more. Those are sexy things.
Yeah.
And that is where we, you know, those are the people that we hold in high esteem.
Right.
Those are the virtuous people, are the people that are willing to self-sacrifice. And, again, in my case, that was certainly true. I was thinking of the story that, I had a boss initially who was just one of the most remarkable people I've encountered in the system, in the healthcare system. And I was going to move into the ER. I was going to sort of advance and go from working in a medical area to the ER. And she caught wind of this and she pulled me aside and said, "You are far too sensitive and empathetic to go into that field." Sensitive meaning you take on too much. You take on other people's pain and other people's suffering, and you're going to go into a sort of a concentrated powder keg of that. And I mean, looking back, that was probably the most wise thing that it was said to me within the healthcare system, or one of them.
What an individual.
And I mean, of course, I look back at that with hindsight, and and that's nursing, and I think doctors are looked at the same way. But within the world of pharmacy, I would imagine it's very much the same. Like you said, you work harder, you work faster, you take on more.
Yeah, basically, there are when you first start, the idea is that you're going to build a thicker skin as time goes on, and you do. But there's a certain type of, it's very rare when you can get somebody who's, like you said, you take on people's pain. You tend to put other people before yourself, most likely. If you took a psychological profile test, you would probably score high in areas of empathy and these types of things. And I'm the same way. So it was not something that I considered as a weakness, and I don't consider it to be a weakness overall, but no. It actually makes me very good at my job, and probably you as well, but it also makes you vulnerable. And if you're not, like, I wasn't paying attention, and I didn't understand how some of the people I was working with could continue under the circumstances that they were and just kind of shake it off and go home. It was hard for me, and I got a little bit better at it, but never good enough. You know, I would still catch myself taking on too much or doing too much or whatever it might be. So, for me, the only solution to that was I got to work less, and I got to draw, there's got to be hard boundaries, right? Like I can't, patients, customers can't have my cell phone number, you know, regardless of the situation. I can't, because, you know, you can get into, I've worked in small towns where, you know, the doctors have my number. I have the doctor's number, 40 or 50 patients in the town have my number. And before you know it, you're a pharmacist full time, no time off. Right. Yeah. And everyone thinks it's great, but it's not good for your mental health.
These are things that I, you know, it is my sincere hope that we might catch a listener who's going through it right now, who's in that dark place. and that they hear some of these qualities that we have, that you and I have, that we've talked about, with sensitivity and perfectionism and pain, and that these are things that sort of understanding that and seeing it within yourself can make you a part of a community that can be really helpful and a really healing thing. And if I had thinking back, if I had have known, if I had heard that about that kind of how much we take on and what the actual sort of physical and physiological impact of that burden and that burden of sensitivity and that burden of perfectionism is, it would have been really, really helpful. I wanted to mention this and see what you thought. Perfectionism to me, because we've used that term a few times in the last two episodes here. To me, it is not just the wanting to complete a task perfectly, or that you hold the task that you're doing to a high standard, that you want to see a perfect result. But it's also that you're telling yourself that it's not, and you're telling yourself that it's not enough, and that what you're doing is not enough.
That's exactly it. Yeah, it doesn't really matter what happens with the task, because it's never good enough.
Yeah,
and as long as, and that's the problem with that trait, I guess. I mean, it's great for a lot of things, because you tend to excel, and especially academically or professionally. But it basically, I think what happens is when you pair that with kind of an emotional or a psychological setup that makes you want to take on too much anyways, you get a situation where you're very quickly overwhelmed, and you're not setting those lines or boundaries up like you should be. And you drive yourself over the deep end.
Yeah. You could have set up a bed and moved into the pharmacy and kept it open 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And it still wouldn't have been enough.
No, there's nothing. And that's the problem. That's a significant problem with me and the entire profession, is that it's designed in such a way is that the job is never really done. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
So it's like it's the same thing for you. It's just it's a rotating process where you're just trying to keep up. And usually you don't quite have enough support to do that. So you're always running, trying to catch up, but you never get to a point where you can say, finally, we've accomplished something. You know, you can have little wins and stuff like that, but you don't get that, you don't get the same feeling as where in other aspects I've worked on projects, personal projects or other business ventures and stuff, where you work really hard and then you get a big payout at the end. And there's something about that seems to work way better with my psyche than this going in 9 to 5 and running on a treadmill. And I'm not saying that, I'm not just speaking about pharmacy. I mean, just generally that might have something to do with the way, there might be a correlation between the perfectionist trait, or maybe it's just, it's another component that's unrelated. I don't know. But for me, it's a big factor.
Yeah. Yeah. No, likewise. And I think it's a kind of a common thread that I've observed. So I wanted to kind of chronologically bring us back in the conversation to sort of the outing of your secret. You and I talked about that we both have come from families with a history of addiction within them, and from fathers with a history of addiction. So I was really curious to hear your experience with that moment of having to come clean, or to share your story with your father, but I mean with your family or whoever you want to kind of tell us about. That's such a massive moment in the story of addiction. So I'd love to hear what that was like for you.
Sure. What happened to me was that I think the burden of how many secrets I was keeping, it was taking a toll on a system that was already overtaxed. And when everything came into the light with the college, and I still was keeping my cards close to my chest. I wasn't, I didn't tell my family. I didn't, I talked to my best friend about it and a couple colleagues that I trusted, and I was looking for advice and stuff, but I certainly didn't tell my parents. I couldn't imagine, you don't want to put that kind of thing on your parents. You don't want to stress them out, and you certainly don't want to tarnish your own image in their eyes. It's just, that's a natural thing. And so I kept it to myself, and my plan was I was going to do all this. I was going to go to treatment as per instructions from the college and the addiction specialist. I was going to do my monitoring. I was going to do everything, and I was going to keep it a secret the whole time.
Wow.
And I was staying at my best friend's at the time. And I can remember just basically laying there one night, and I drifted off to sleep, and I had a dream that seemed to strip away a lot of, in the dream, I saw myself as reduced is the wrong word. I saw myself exposed at the very core of what I was, just my ego and my psyche and, all the things that were false, all the things that I was carrying that were costing psychic energy. It takes a certain amount of energy to keep any secret. Right. Yeah. And I saw all this stuff in a kind of a visual representation, and it was moving, and it kind of broke me down in a strange way. And when I woke up in the morning, I thought, this is ridiculous. I can't continue with this hiding, whatever the situation is. And I ended up calling up a colleague that I respect a lot. And I kind of discussed it with her a little bit, and she kind of came to, she was encouraging in that she thought that it would be best for me to get my family on my side. You need your support people. Right. And so I called them up, and I told them what was going on, and it was a brutal, brutal situation. Of course, they were completely, they were shocked, but they were, loving and, supportive, as you can imagine. I'm very fortunate to have fantastic parents that way. Which, that's not the case for some people. It was at that was my first experience with seeing such a contrast between the burden of carrying that around and the enlightenment of shedding that lie.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
And it was, there was something maybe a little bit rejuvenating about it. It gave me hope when there was no hope for a long time. Like for years, I was just living expecting to either, die or continue. I mean, I didn't know really, there was no long-term agenda. I figured that, whenever I started to think too much about it, I would just take more drugs, right? Yeah. So having this situation where all of a sudden things are in play, and maybe, just maybe, there's a shred of hope that things could get better, And that was, you bring it up, but it's, I can remember it quite vividly. I mean, that was a lot, you know, within whatever that was, one night and waking up and then just, yeah, it was a catharsis for sure.
It's a moment that to me felt like a traumatic experience in itself to see if in my case it was in person, to see the look on my parents' face, like this split second of shock and grief and pain. It was a trauma and yeah, a major catharsis. You know, I would relate it to the feeling of being underwater for a really long time and you kind of finally come up for air.
Yeah.
To it feeling like that, like that. And, you know, it's if, you know, like Dr. Mate relates a lot of it to a lot of the origins of addiction to childhood pain and trauma. And the act of even if you're 35 years old, of going to your parents and letting them know who you are and going to them for, in my case, I think I was going to them for support and like almost safety on a subconscious level.
Sure.
If the origins of addiction are about sort of partly about the wounded child, it's quite a profound thing to go to the safety of your parents and to be fortunate enough to have that. That's something that I'm profoundly grateful for. I don't know what my story would have looked like if I didn't have that safety net. And
yeah.
And I think, you know, it's funny, you and I both, the timeline was probably a little bit different, but for me, I had gone to a couple of friends and there was one friend of mine in particular who just, I'd love to go back and look in my phone at how many times he said to me, just tell them, just tell your parents. And everything can begin from there. And that sort of that the freedom is in that action. And he was completely right. And to me, the shit hitting the fan with work was secondary to that. All of the issues with my career were secondary to that. But if you can remove that mask and come, you know, expose yourself in like you said, in your truest form. In the truest form of who you are, that's such a major starting point.
Absolutely. And yeah, you bring up a really good point there. And it's something that I experienced too, which is an abrupt shift in the way your priorities are perceived. By that, I mean, before I divulge that information to my parents, I was thinking more along the lines of what's this going to do to my career? What's this going to do to me financially? And once I laid my cards on the table, I realized that that's all nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, obviously there's responsibilities, financial responsibilities with, you know, being a citizen, of whatever Canada country you're from. But in comparison to your life and what it would mean to your parents, what if you didn't, you know, what if you kept hiding and kept having the same problem and you died? You know, those ideas go through your mind and you look at their face and you're like, Jesus, what am I doing? Like, how on earth could I take such risks? You know?
Yeah.
And it shifts, the perspective shifts and you think, I don't give a shit about what happens with my career. I don't give a shit in comparison to what needs to be done here. This is a serious situation that needs to be addressed yesterday. You know?
Yeah. And that little bit of a delay that we both experienced in telling our parents, it's almost like just like the last dying gasps of that addiction saying like no, if you don't tell them, then we can still be in secret, we can still stay in the shadows. And not to say that it goes away after that, but to me, it's like it was like a powerful voice that was saying, just, you know, once you tell them, then it's really, you can't go back from there. It makes it made it so much more real.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's that little voice that, will be with me forever, that, is constantly going to be driving towards that end. And it wants me to be isolated, and it wants me to keep everything to myself. Right. Yeah. And that way I break all connections with all support systems. That way, my probability of getting into trouble with any kind of substance is increased. It's simple as far as that part of my mind is concerned, and it's constantly working towards that end. You know, so it's a fascinating, the human mind, how it can, you know, we're basically walking around believing that we're in control and thinking that we are not being manipulated by external forces on a regular basis, but we are. You know, we have much less control than we believe, for sure.
Yeah, totally. And speaking it out loud, literally speaking it out loud, to the safe people in our lives that we can, that is a counter to that little creepy little quiet voice that tells us that all of the negativity. For me, I've had to actively sort of speak it, and the more I do that, the easier it is to counter that negative voice, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. We should give that voice a name. We'll think of something.
Many do. Yeah.
Cause he's a crafty bastard, that one.
So our stories differ in that, I got sort of the opportunity to do, an outpatient rehab program from my kitchen table. You did not. You took what is a much more common route, or a much more common route was imposed on you, mm-hmm. at that time, and you went to a residential treatment, yeah, out of province. So yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and can you tell us when, in the sort of timeline, you'd gone to your parents? How long after that did you have to go away to treatment?
Okay, so we're probably maybe 4 or 5 months, I guess, would have been the gap there.
Wow.
Yeah. So February. Yeah. Something like that. So yeah, I'm kind of in limbo, waiting to go to a facility. My first physician that I saw, really blindsided me, and, I didn't feel that we were getting off to a productive start. And I requested of my college that I be transferred to a different physician. And I'm in hindsight, I'm really glad that I did, because the physician I ended up with was excellent. To this day, we still talk, and she helps me out with, when I have questions about, how their part of the process works, she helps me out with that, and vice versa. So that turned out to be a positive there, but unfortunately, the way the system is set up right now, if you go in and say that you use any kind of substance, it wouldn't matter. You could go in and say, I have a glass of wine every night after work. That's pretty much going to be enough to be sent to rehab. Yeah. So, I mean, that topic is, maybe there's a lot of content there that we could talk about on another show. But for me, I'm from BC, and I was living in the Shuswap at the time, and I saw a doctor in Kamloops who requested that I go to Guelph, Ontario. And I couldn't understand why that was. I understand now why it was, and we can talk about how that affects the taxpayer and all that type of stuff. But anyway, so I was sent for 5 weeks at a center where, you know, I said, well, why am I being sent across the country? Why can't I go to treatment here? Well, you can't go here because they don't have anything that's specific for healthcare professionals. And okay. So I get over there, and this is like, I don't know. It looked like a very minimal, low budget, poorly run facility. And as far as what the special treatment for healthcare professionals was, a once weekly meeting where the healthcare professionals got together.
That was it.
I mean, what is this? Other than that, it was basically having a 12-step program force-fed to you. And if you didn't get on board with that, you're kicked out. So I made it about 2 weeks into that program, and I was starting to draw a lot of attention. I'd been taken aside a few times for asking too many questions. And well, the first thing, that was a day two, we go in there and we're going to get this guy. He's going to give us a kind of a presentation on drugs and how they work and stuff. So, oh, okay, let's see what goes on here. So here comes this guy. He's a doctor. He couldn't have been a shade under 400 pounds, this guy. Tells us he used to be addicted to crack cocaine. So I'm like, okay, so you're still addicted to something. You have not dealt with that problem at all. You've shifted it. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But the guy, I'm cured. And in my mind, that person was not cured. It just changed strategies. But anyway, there was a point in the presentation where he put up a slide that was methylphenidate. Methamphetamine, like meth, hardcore meth. And he's putting it up, and this is what it does to your, but he was saying that it was MDMA. And he's saying, this is what MDMA does to your brain. And I'm like, holy shit, that's not even close to what I like. This is completely wrong and dangerous, because I there was a girl behind me who's crying. She was in there because her parents found out she was doing ecstasy. And now here's this doctor telling her that her brain is disintegrated because of her, and never, irreparably, basically. This is what he's saying. So I was like, my God. I went up to him afterwards. I said, where do you know where you got that slide from? And kind of questioned him about it. And I showed him that was in fact not MDMA, and that's not how it works and everything. And he was gracious, and he's like, oh, thank you so much. I've been using that slide for a long time, and I never realized that. And I'm like, how long? 15 years. Like 15 years you've been telling people. So every person who comes in this facility has been leaving thinking that their brain is damaged, as if they've been doing meth for, whatever. I mean, it would judge by the, I mean, he was showing a lot of neurotransmitter damage, which doesn't, I mean, for anyone who's interested, it doesn't typically happen with MDMA. And like, you really have to hammer on it for a long, long time. And it's not, those are two very different drugs. So I couldn't believe it. But anyway, that doctor was kind and gracious to my face, but then he went to the administration. Hey, this guy's causing problems.
Yeah.
So then I was asking questions about, just the way the 12-step situation was set up that I didn't understand, and that didn't make a lot of sense to me. And at any rate, I had one of my best buddies now that we met there, and he pulled me aside and he said, look, man, I got kicked out doing exactly what you're doing. It's up to you, but if you keep going, you're going to get kicked out. And all that's going to happen is your career will be finished, or you'll be sent back here to do it again. And I'm like, what? I was mad, right? I was like, this is bullshit. And he said, it doesn't matter. He said, you can learn to play the game and get through and go home and get your license back, or you can get mad and see if you can change something. And it's like, oh, son of a bitch, this guy's right. So from that, so after that, all of a sudden I was, I was compliant and did what was necessary. And, I received a big, whatever letter at the end that I was cured. It's just preposterous. Yep. And away I went, and then went back into a was signed into a 3-year monitoring contract which I think was the most useful part. I mean, I didn't get much out of the rehab other than a really good friend. I'm super grateful for that. And I did meet some incredible people there. The program itself, I thought, was just, I mean, antiquated would be a kind description. So when I got back, I was put into a 3-year monitoring contract. And that, I think, is the only way that I could be convinced to go back into a pharmacy. I was ready to hang it up. I'd accepted I had a buddy who'd set me up with a job up north, and I was just going to entirely change careers. Because of the monitoring, I felt safe enough in that I knew that even if I was back in a pharmacy and something happened, I wouldn't last long, you know. Best case scenario, like maybe I get away with it for 2 weeks before I show up on a urine, right? So that 2 weeks is not really enough to get yourself in a lot of trouble. So I put all this, you know, 7 years of school after my undergrad, and you know, it's a lot of time and effort, and why not? I'll give it another shot. So I did, and I think it was the right move to go back and give it another shot, but I can tell you that it's not been easy, and it's still hard, and I still have to limit my exposure time in there. And I just don't see a day where that is going to be a comfortable position for me, you know?
How soon after leaving treatment did you go back to work?
I was out at the end of June 2013, and I think I was back to work September-ish, something like that.
Yeah, pretty quick.
Yeah, and I was lucky. I mean, the restrictions on my license, the physician was, she really worked hard to make it possible for me to get back to work, because it'd be very difficult for pharmacists given the restrictions that are normally put on. For instance, you're not allowed to handle narcotics. So you can imagine how difficult that is to be a pharmacist. Another one is usually you're not allowed to work alone. This is a big problem. Or they'll say you have to work with another pharmacist. That's going to eliminate a lot of positions the way things are now. So she was able to make it so that I was able to find a position. And then because I was lucky enough to have worked for a gentleman who was able to basically accommodate me, that I was able to get back to work. And that gentleman's name is Mike, and I'm very grateful for that. Then I was back in September, and away I went.
And at that point, were you involved in a community, a recovery community, through meetings, support groups at that point?
When you're in a monitoring contract, they want you to attend, they still use the, like the peer support group of some sort. They suggest, 12 steps or smart recovery, stuff like that. So I was more interested in the smart recovery groups, and I went that way. I actually ended up getting trained as a facilitator for that. And, kind of use that as a jump off point to start my other business.
And that was my next question to you, was at how soon after that did you sort of create the community for healthcare workers yourself?
Well, it was a while. I got through my entire contract, and I was back out the other end and practicing without being monitored. And I wanted to know if that was possible first. And seeing that I wasn't, you know, I was able to still count Percocet and do that thing without going off the deep end. I thought, okay, well, I appear to be in better shape now. And from what I witnessed with some of the peer support groups when I did go to rehab, there were times when I thought, man, if I ever get the chance, I should do something that makes this a little bit easier, or at least help somebody because when you're in that position, it doesn't take much, just very little, like one person being honest with you or one person being actually giving a shit and listening to what you say. Because a lot of the process is very, like the reason we call this podcast Recovery Machine is because that's what it feels like when you're in that process, when you get stamped, you get sent off, you get processed through the facility. And then when you're back, you're basically monitored, right?
Yeah.
Much like, you know, I mean, the whole thing is very robotic. It's not, there's not a lot of humanity involved. And, you know, there's economic reasons for that. There's bureaucratic reasons for that. But whatever the case may be, I thought if I had a chance, maybe I could take some of the things that I've learned and continue to learn about addiction, recovery, this type of stuff, because it seems to be a field that's it's continually evolving, and it's endless. Like, I mean, I've been running meetings through Obsidian since 2017, and I still learn something new probably every week, which is, I mean, how many fields are like that as far as, and this isn't because I have a group of scientists that are attending the meetings. These are healthcare professionals who are going through a similar related problem, and we're just working through stuff together, and we're finding out ways to make things work, and we find out ways to avoid things that don't work. And it's very interesting. I like that type of stuff.
It is. The key word there for me was humanity, that within the confines of a pretty rigid feeling system and a process that feels like there's not a lot of autonomy and that can feel like you're being just churned through. For me, the most enduring moments and lessons have been seeing the humanity in others, hearing other people's stories, and safely being able to share my own story. And this is sort of where our stories kind of naturally converge. It is, you know, I think a common thing for people must be that initial resistance to having to go into a situation where they're sharing their story, and it's sharing a very personal, oftentimes ugly, shame-based or shameful story.
Yeah.
And the safety of the community and the strength that develops internally as a result of that community is huge. And you know, I too attended and still attend Smart Recovery meetings. And I remember sort of the first day I met you, Nathan, those meetings for me were particularly something that I feared, because it's one thing to share sort of on general terms with quote unquote civilians who don't know the healthcare field, and you're talking about addiction, and that's one thing. But to go into a room with other professionals who maybe are the exact same professionals or people who are doctors or pharmacists or whatever they may be, it's intimidating and really scary initially. And the feeling of safety was almost immediate for me, and the feeling of camaraderie was almost immediate for me. But it's essential that there's safety created in that. And
What the big problem I saw when I was over east with some of these what they're called as caduceus meetings. These are the meetings that are basically, they're like 12-step meetings, but not 12-step based, but they're the same type of recovery meeting for healthcare professionals or what we call safety sensitive professionals. The reason they're put together just with healthcare professionals is usually because there can be repercussions in the community. If you know, say a doctor's working in a small community, they could attend you know, regular meetings, but unfortunately it's difficult to protect your confidentiality. You know, in reality, lots of times there's backlash and problems associated with that. And with healthcare professionals, our back to work program and the whole machine thing is different, and it's an entity that you have to wrestle with on its own. So when I saw what was going on over there, what they're also called is accountability meetings, and it was the most embarrassed I'd ever been to be a healthcare professional. What I saw there were you're talking veterinarians, surgeons, nurses, just a whole room of people accusing each other, and I didn't see a shred of support. I didn't understand the point, the purpose. And so when I got back, I thought about it, and what was missing was honesty. You can't build trust without honesty. And that's it. I mean, if you're anybody who, you take any person and you put them in a group of people, it takes them less than 5 minutes to feel out whether or not what's going on there is authentic or not. And if you're authentic with people and open with them, then at least you're saying, I'm willing to put it on the table in the hopes that something there might be something there that helps you. And I don't care what, if you think that makes me a shitty person or a weaker person or whatever, that's fine. I'm willing to take that risk. I'm willing to be vulnerable to potentially help somebody who's in a shitty situation. And when people see that, they usually respond in kind. There's not everybody, I've had members come in and they take a look, and a lot of times it's specialists, and they just, you can tell that they're too, they're just not ready, or they don't like the idea of being that open, or whatever the situation may be. And that's fine. Maybe they do better in another group. But for me, if everybody does their best to kind of put their cards on the table, then we can at least start to sort through what's going on and deal with some of these issues that are going on with the machine, and then just the normal day-to-day issues that people experience when they're in a contract or even after.
So yeah, I not to be too much of a idealist, and I'm not an idealist necessarily, but imagine if that existed beforehand. I think when I joining that community, joining the Caduceus groups and in your Obsidian community, every meeting that I leave, I end up thinking, Jesus, I wish I found this years ago. Before addiction took hold, where I could just have that outlet and have that sense of community, be able to say, God, I've had a hard week. God, I'm stressed out tonight. This is really bugging me. The value of community can happen before addiction. If I could go back to myself before this all happened, I would tell myself, be a part of a community. Join a community, whatever it may be, because that the value of that, of sharing and sort of that reciprocity is immeasurable when you're struggling. Even if it's really tough, there's a big gift in it. And my hope for people who walk away and say, this isn't for me, is that they find something out there that resonates with them, that feels safe and comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. The difference between having that and not having that, it can make or break you, regardless of where you are. I mean, for a while, the kind of engagement that I have with that group can ebb and flow, and sometimes I think, gee, why are you doing this to yourself, man? It's like going back to Vietnam. Not really. It's nowhere near Vietnam. Don't get me wrong, but it's like I'm exposing myself to that same kind of system that brought me a lot of pain and suffering. And I think, why are you, why do this to yourself? Why continue? But then it'll be, I'll come away from getting together with you guys and I'll have a totally new perspective. And I say, that's why, because you, it's not like, okay, you're through your monitoring contract, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's still, there's still value in people getting together and talking about this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, if that's one thing I tried in the beginning, my original goal with Obsidian was to attempt to get people before the machine gets them. Right. So they had an option and they could see what, because unfortunately they kind of, once you go in there and once you're sort of captured, there's no going back. You're legally, you're kind of screwed. So that was my original idea, was try to get people before the machine gets them. But, and maybe this will do that. And, yeah. You know, if there is people out there that are in a situation where they're contemplating what to do next and they're having real trouble and they want some support, email us. Email is on the Recovery Machine on Spotify. It's us at recoverymachine.org. So us at recoverymachine.org. Just email us and we'd be happy to talk options with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the benefit of reaching out and being a part of a dialogue and seeing the humanity of other people and feeling compassion towards other people will ultimately, I believe, help to breed compassion towards ourselves. And certainly has done that for me.
Yeah, that is the idea. I mean, again, I think we both were kind of in the same boat with, I mean, it took me probably 2 years before I stopped being super upset with myself.
Yeah.
You know, I really beat the shit out of myself for a long time. And, it's tough to get back to a spot where you're like, okay, you know what? I'm a human being. This is part of the whole thing, the whole life thing. It's all about mistakes and challenges and what happens when you face them and go through them. That's kind of the whole deal. So, I mean, sometimes maybe it is for people like us or people who could relate that we do have to kind of go out there and try to connect first with people and try to help. And then later you're able to turn that inward and, you know, walk away the better for it.
Yeah, that's ideal. Well, Nathan, I think this is a good point to wrap up. Thank you for your vulnerability and for your openness with sharing your story with myself and with our listeners. Now that we've kind of put together both of our stories and shown where we linked up, we've got a lot more content to cover, and we want to sort of get into a little bit more about what the different steps of working through the process of like you have said, pre-contemplation to entering the machine, to getting into a rehab facility or into a program and coming out the other side. There's lots there to discuss, and lots more sort of specific aspects of recovery and addiction that we'll touch on.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So, we'll call it there. It's about the same time or the same amount of time as we did with you, I guess. Fairly
yep.
close.
Yep.
Thanks, Corey. That was a good interview. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, good. Likewise. Thanks, Nathan.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Sounds good.
Cheers.